Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Project Empowerment with Kathleen, a show dedicated to empowering lives everywhere by bringing you people, stories, ideas, and inspiration to help each of us make our world a better place. And if you'd like to participate during today's show, you can log into the chat room at projectempowerment.info, or if you want to, you're welcome to call in with questions at area code 347-945-5441. And today I'm super excited to have on author, poet, and one of the leading authorities in Japanese psychology in North America, Greg Creech. His work has been featured in the Sun Magazine, Tricycle, Self, Mutiny Reader, Counseling Today, Cosmopolitan, and Experience Life. He's also the director of the To-Do Institute. And we're going to be discussing his newest book, The Art of Taking Action, Lessons in Japanese Psychology. This beautiful book draws on Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, Japanese psychology, Zen, and martial arts to offer an approach to action that goes beyond productivity and time management. He addresses practical issues such as procrastination, stress, anxiety, and indecision through the lens of classic Eastern wisdom. And it's not just about getting things done. It's about what you do, how you do it, and impact your action and inaction in the world around you. And so we're going to be discussing all of this. So thank you so much for joining me today, Greg. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to be on my show.
Well, it's great to be here, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So first of all, you do a lot of very cool things. I was looking at your website at the To-Do Institute, and maybe we could start with that a little bit, just kind of put it out there for the listeners. What exactly is the To-Do Institute? What do you do there? It's an actual location. It's in Vermont. Is that correct?
Yes, it's in the foothills of the Green Mountains in Vermont. We're in a lovely little hillside facing south. It's a 12-acre property that's surrounded by another 300 or 400 acres of kind of undeveloped woods. And so it's a retreat center, and we do everything from kind of week-long, we call Nikon retreats, where people come in and do a retreat that's mostly solitude, about reflecting on your life. And then we also do more active programs, including the certification program in Japanese psychology, where people come in for a 10-day residential program and kind of learn about this material in a very realistic, community-based, face-to-face way.
Mm. So 10-day, and you, okay, I work, my day job is at a children's hospital. I work at a pediatric hospital here in Seattle in the emergency department, and the residents there, they spend years in school. So when you said a 10-day thing, so is it like more of an introduction, or is this more of an in-depth class, or I'm just really curious
This is really more of a kind of an in-depth, intensive experience. So, you know, the idea is to basically gather a small community of people who really want to learn to apply this to their lives, and then each day becomes kind of a practice day. So we start with meditation in the morning, and you finish with a period of self-reflection in the evening. There's presentations, group presentations in the morning. You actually have an individual session each day with either me or one of the other trainers, and you get assignments and actual homework assignments that you work on in the course of the afternoon. And those assignments have to do with developing particular what we call mental wellness skills that relate to your attention or to self-reflection, or another one is the skill of coexisting with feelings, which we'll probably get into a little bit today as we talk about the art of taking action. But the whole idea is to really give you a very kind of practical real-life setting where you have to live with other people and, you know, cook your own food and wash your own dishes, and at the same time you're kind of back away from your life and disconnected with your own personal life, so that you can really open up and try to learn how to live a little bit differently and then take that back with you.
That's beautiful, because, I mean, there's a lot of, like at the work at the hospital that I work at, they actually visited Japan a few years ago, and theirs was more of a corporate reasoning. You know, they learned the Toyota way as far as production and working with staff, working with, you know, not decrease, I don't want to say use the word eliminating, but decreasing accidents that can happen and improving mm-hmm. patient care, et cetera. So it's really interesting. That's why I'm so intrigued by your work, because so much of this can be interwoven into, obviously, like you said, in your own daily personal life, but also in your work and the work environment.
Absolutely. I think wherever you have a community setting, you know, whether it's a family or an organization or a department within a corporation, I think many of the same kind of principles apply that have to do, again, with, you know, skillful attention, with reflecting on the impact you're having on people around you. You know, these are all aspects of mental health and mental wellness that I think are important in terms of creating successful experiences within a group.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to be bringing your book, to my work. I do a monthly newsletter, part of our department, and so I do a lot of the book reviews. And so your book is next on the list
because
I really want people to be exposed to this information. I personally really enjoyed your work. So let's talk a little bit about your story, about your, you know, how you got involved in doing what you do. I mean, did you grow up with this type of stuff? I mean, what was it that interested you in this Eastern, I hate to use the word philosophy, but this whole, the ideas of all of this, what was it that kind of got you on this path?
Well, you know, I think back to my years in college, which were quite a few years ago, I already had developed an interest in meditation and hypnosis. And it was probably kind of the beginnings of my interest in approaches from the East, we might refer to them as. But, you know, I teach an annual course online called Living on Purpose, where we actually try to, you know, help people kind of figure out what their purpose is in life. And of course, a lot of it has to do with trying to step back and think about what kind of legacy you want to leave and what you can do with your life that would be really meaningful and what kind of unique contribution you can make. And a lot of those types of things lead you to proactive steps that you can take, right? But for me, and certainly other people are in this situation, for me, where I am now really had a lot to do with just this work kind of falling into my lap. You know, I'd never set out to become an author of books on Japanese psychology or the director of a nonprofit retreat center. When I originally discovered this work just from reading a book, my interest in it was really personal. You know, I was struggling with some challenges in my life in terms of relationships and in terms of anxiety, and I had been studying Buddhism at that time for a number of years. And I was kind of put off by traditional Western psychology because I found it hard to reconcile some of the principles of Western psychology with some of the values and ideas in Buddhism and Eastern philosophy. For example, I would be working with these wonderful Buddhist teachers who would talk about selflessness and service, and then you would go to the self-help section in a bookstore, and you'd see a book on relationships called Looking Out for Number One, right? Or How to Get the Love You Want. And it always seemed very self-centered to me compared with what I considered to be very elegant and admirable principles that I was studying in terms of Eastern philosophy and religion. So when I discovered that there were approaches to psychology that really were not religious, but kind of came from the same set of values, I really got very excited about it because I found that it was very consistent with my spiritual and religious views. And so it was a lot more comfortable to embrace an approach to psychology that was a good fit with my spiritual values.
I love that. And, you know, you're so right about the self-help industry. I mean, it's a bazillion-dollar, whatever the dollar amount is. And there's a book out there for pretty much everything. And I've also personally been drawn more to the Eastern ideas because of, I think a lot of it just feels so much simpler. It's not so complex. It is complex, but it isn't, if that makes any sense at all. Because, you know, I'm reading through your book, and one of the things that, you know, you emphasize in the very, very beginning is, like, you know, this book may or may not be for you, and you're very open about that, which I was like, this is cool. Because people, you know, obviously they need to make that choice themselves, but it's not about keeping a to-do list. It's not a typical how to organize your life from A to Z type of book. And that's what I personally really enjoyed about it, because it gives that, here's some tools to use, here's some ideas to think about, and here's how you can apply it by you. And you share many examples, plus you have many contributors that have shared. So I just wanted to say thank you for writing this, because I personally really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, it's one of the ways that I look at this whole area of personal productivity, or, you know, the kind of philosophy of one's life as it relates to taking action, is I think that there are two extremes, you know, and mm-hmm. one extreme, I think, probably falls more into the kind of traditional Western perspective, and at the extreme, you know, that has to do with, like, okay, here's my 10-year plan, and here's my 5-year mm-hmm. plan, and here's my goals for the year, and here's my action steps for those goals.
Yeah.
And then here's my to-do lists, and I have to make sure before I go to bed tonight I get all this checked off. And so that's kind of, you know, one extreme. There's a sense that you really have complete control, and you always need to be very, it's kind of a left brain, you know, very logical, rational, analytical approach to moving forward in your life. And the problem with that, you know, is essentially that it doesn't factor in what is true for most of us, that life doesn't unfold the way we plan it to unfold. And we're faced with sudden emergencies and challenges and unexpected events, both pleasant and unpleasant, that we have to work with. But the other extreme is what I call the kind of wandering monk approach to life. And, you know, I have in our library here, we have a lot of books on Zen and Buddhism, and, you know, some of my favorite kind of traditional characters, even heroes in Zen, are these wandering monks like Yokan, and they build little huts, you know, up on top of the mountains, and they don't really have any contact with civilization, you know, for years and years, or they just kind of wander around and periodically stumble onto a temple where they meditate for a few days and then move on. And I have a lot of respect for people who want to live their life that way, but not too many of us actually do. You know, most of us are kind of in between those two extremes. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be, you know, kind of overwhelmed with our 10-year and 5-year plan and checking things off so much. And on the other hand, we don't really want to have a life where we just kind of wander aimlessly without any vision or direction or goals. And so, you know, Buddhism is often referred to as the approach of the middle path. And I really think that my book tries to capture that. You know, it's a way of helping people kind of head in the right direction, but at the same time realizing that you can do what you can do in terms of moving forward in your life. But a lot of what we need to do in order to be successful is to respond to life as it unfolds in front of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, there were some things that you shared in your book that we'll talk about. I'm holding myself back because I want to talk about it now, but I want to save it for a little bit later. That reminds me of another author that I had on recently, and how symbiotic these ideas are. And it's like, for me, it's very heartwarming because I, you know, I've gone to, you know, personal development seminars because I was in a place where I was just looking, looking for something bigger than me. You know, mm-hmm. my I have two kids also. I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and when my boys were small, they both were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And when uh-huh. my first one got sick, it was, you know, it was a blow because it's a whole life-changing thing. You know, they're insulin dependent. But then when my second one got sick, it really threw me into, I hate to use the term depression, but I had a hard time with it because I couldn't figure out why, you know, because it doesn't, there's like no history of it in the family. We've done DNA testing through JZRF, all of this stuff, like what is the reason why behind this, but then also how to manage it and deal with it and then take on yet another, it's like bringing home another baby. So it was my kind of like a turning point for me in my life where even though it was kind of a sad negative thing, it was a positive thing in the long run because it helped me personally focus on what can I do that's bigger than me besides just focusing on diabetes all the time and raising children. And so I went through a phase of, you know, I went to seminars and I learned, you know, different things from different, you know, professionals. And I look back and one of, you know, there was one that is very rigid about the whole to-do list and the whole five-year plan and 10-year plan. And honestly, I can't do those. They just, it's like, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. How can I make my plan like that? And it's like part of me admires people that are able to do that. And part of me, it scares me because it's like life happens. You know, this is a case in point. My kids got sick and I had to, what I thought was happening in my world got flipped upside down and we had to tweak and adjust. So I was, that's why I think why I enjoy this because of the flexibility, but you still need some structure, you know, you still have to function and take care of life, you know?
And I think the, I think the critical thing and part of what I hear in the story that you just shared with me is trying to find something that you can contribute to the world that goes beyond
right.
your own self-interest, you know. And
right.
I often think of it as kind of where do you draw the circle? And, you know, there are people who draw the circle just around themselves, which means everything is kind of designed towards how can I make my life better? And then there are people, you know, often people with families and kids who draw the circle around their immediate family, right? And so everything is designed towards, you know, these are the people inside the circle and everybody else is outside. But the people to me who come, you know, maybe closest to being defined as enlightened are really people who draw a very wide circle or a circle around everybody and everything. And I think that as we move in the direction of trying to see our lives as opportunities to contribute to the world in some meaningful way, not just to make ourselves happy, not just to take care of our own kids, but to really look at how can we improve other people's lives, how can we reduce suffering, how can we, you know, help the planet in terms of the situation we're in with global warming, that as we take on missions that go beyond our own self-interest, we often find so much greater fulfillment than we would ever find if we just stayed kind of tightly bound up in just worrying about ourselves and our own happiness.
I absolutely agree. You know, it helped me personally heal through a lot of things. Like back, because in my past, you know, prior children, pre-second ex-husband, my first ex-husband, I fled for my life. I was in a domestic violence situation. I lived in a shelter for battered women. And when I was there in the shelter, I don't remember being one of those women. I mean, I had a lot of emotional stuff I was dealing with, but I don't remember being one of those women that wanted to stay the victim. You know, I wanted to heal from it, and I wanted to find a way to give back in some way, shape, or form. And it was then that I knew I was going to write my story. I wrote a book about it a few years ago. It was published. But it took over, I don't know, like 15 years for me to finally have the courage to write out all, you know, the stuff that I dealt with. But I did it in a way where I wanted to help other women. I wanted to give them that, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And that was a phrase that I learned in the shelter. It was the light at the end of the tunnel isn't always a train. And so, you know, through my years of, you know, learning from different people, different authors, different everything, so that's how I put my book together. But then when that was done, I knew I needed to do something more. So that's when I launched this radio show. I've been doing this for 5 years now. And it's been so enlightening and so empowering to, you know, it first started off with the focus on the domestic violence, just giving resources is what my focus was, to help other people who are in that situation, how to help themselves get out of it and then rebuild their lives and find empowering ways to rebuild their lives. And so since then, you know, my focus has been mainly on wonderful books like yours and having authors on who are doing something. You know, it's not just writing a book and, hey, this is me now. You have other things that you're doing, and that's what I admire. I admire, you know, the To-Do Institute, and, you know, there's all of these other people that I've spoken with that do other things besides just writing, if that makes any sense. But I kind of went off on a tangent there.
Well, you know, I think that about 2 years ago, actually, our organization got a grant from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and we did 2 weeks of training up in Homer, Alaska, for the primary domestic violence program there, where we had the chance to work, you know, primarily with the staff as far as training them in the materials, some of which you've read in my book, as well as with some of the women in the shelter and even with some of the offenders that they worked with in an offender group. And, you know, it was really wonderful to see how they were taking that material and applying it in a very specific way to helping these women, you know, who in many cases were full of fear and anxiety and sometimes hopeless, and kind of helping them turn around their lives and seeing how, you know, by taking action and coexisting with those feelings of fear, anxiety, that they could really do something and start to rebuild their lives into something that was meaningful.
I love that. Yeah, that we had, when I was in the shelter, we had different people come in, different speakers, et cetera. And I don't recall anyone from, you know, doing that type of work. And I'm excited about that because I could see the benefit of that. Simply because, you know, this is not complicated stuff to learn. And there's so much that, you know, you share in your book. Just the simple fact of what is action. I mean, I love the intro here about how there's this new discovery that helps people achieve their goals. And you really build it up, and I love it. And all it's taking action. But the thing is it's the type of action that we take. And that's where in your work you delve into that, because you could sit at your desk and say, I'm going to write a book, but you're just pushing pencils around and reorganizing and shuffling papers, doesn't get that first sentence done. And so I guess it's you explain how what is this action that we need to take? What does it really mean? And those types of things. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, in fact, just about 2 days ago, the Guardian newspaper and magazine in England just ran a book review, and the man who wrote the review, the last sentence in his review, I really loved, because he said, and I'll have to paraphrase here, he said that, you know, getting things done in your life when they need to be done is pretty close to a superpower. You know, when the superpowers we think of, you know, being able to fly or having this tremendous strength or, you know, being able to move objects with our thoughts or something. But in a very practical sense, you know, if we can develop the capacity in our lives just to do the things that are really important to do when they need to be done, I mean, that's a tremendous superpower at a very practical level.
Right. Yeah, I do start my day, like some things, you know, I do need to write down because I've got kids and life is busy, and I'm like, oh gosh, I got to make sure I pull all these papers for taxes, which I got my taxes done last week. I was quite proud of myself.
Oh, and, you know,
thank you. And so, you know, it's the things that you do to organize and manage your life, and it is the simple baby steps. I mean, I've known people who their world is in constant chaos. I mean, they can't even find the toaster in their kitchen because it's so chaotic. And so that is an extreme example.
Uh-huh.
And then there's people that I've known that they can't handle a book sitting on a counter. It has to be put away. They don't want anything, you know, they want their home to look like nobody lives there. And in my head, that's like super extreme right there. So it's just a matter of finding what is right for the individual. You share something in here that I really liked. It was in the first part, and it's help me pronounce, it's Nikan, N-A-I-K-A-N. How do you pronounce that?
It's actually pronounced Nikon, like the camera.
Oh, okay, so Nikon. So there was three questions that you can ask, and I thought these were very empowering. What have I received from, with a question mark, what have I given to, and then finish the sentence, and the same thing, what troubles and difficulties have I caused? I thought that third one was really interesting because we don't think about that. We just focus on what am I going to do and how am I going to accomplish it. Can we talk about that a little bit? That'd be,
sure.
be enlightening.
You know, in Japanese psychology, there really are these kind of two complementary elements. There's the reflection or the contemplative side of our approach to life, and there's the action side, right? And the three questions you're talking about, which comprise an approach from Japan called Nikon, which means something like inside looking or looking from the inside, and it's really a contemplative approach to self-reflection, and it's something that we do retreats on, but that people can do simply as a way of kind of finishing up their day, even in bed at night before you go to sleep, and it uses those three questions. So if you were to, let's say, reflect on your day, at the end of the day, you would say, well, what did I receive from others today? And you would look in a very practical sense as, you know, my wife made me coffee this morning, and my daughter stopped and picked up a muffin for me on the way home from school, someone on our staff came into the office and processed some book orders, and, you know, you would have a very practical list of things that people did for you, right? And then the second question is kind of what did I give back, right? What did I do for others? So maybe I did some grocery shopping for my family, or I drove my daughter to her basketball practice, or I took my dog for a walk. And so that would be the second question. And the third question that you're kind of making reference to, which is really the most unusual, is what troubles and difficulties did I cause others? And that's often a question that people are very uncomfortable with, that we don't like to actually look at ourselves and try to look at how did we cause problems to others. And we tend to naturally gravitate towards the exact opposite, right, which is being very aware of how other people caused us trouble.
Right.
You know, that person cut me off in the traffic when I was going to work this morning, and this person was late for their meeting and they kept me waiting. You know, the problem with looking at how other people are kind of messing up is that that's their lives and we don't really have any control over their behavior.
Right.
So when we flood ourselves with information about how people caused us trouble, we're really flooding ourselves with information about life that we really can't do anything about. I can't keep this person from being late. I can't keep people from cutting me off on the highway. And when you keep focusing on that, you get very depressed and frustrated, even resentful about it. The question of how did I cause other people troubles and difficulties, it doesn't make me feel good, but it gives me very realistic information about how I'm impacting on the world around me, right? How did I impact on my kids today? How did I impact on the people I work with in the office? How did I impact on my students in this course? And that impact sometimes includes that I'm late with things, or I cause people problems, or I didn't respond to a question that they emailed me about. And it's helpful for me to look at that because I can actually do something about that. That's my own conduct in the world, right? So it's something that I have some control over, whereas other people's conduct or behavior I really don't have any control over.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at those three questions, and it just kind of captures our experience for that day. And we have a maxim that we use in our training called your experience of life is not based on your life, it's based on what you pay attention to. And so one of the things that often happens when we go through those three questions, particularly just the first question, what did I receive from others, is that we realize that even though we have this long list of things that we may have received from others, we spent so much of our mental energy focusing on the one or two things that really pissed me off today, right? That people did that really got me upset or bothered me. And that's where my attention was, and that's where my experience then becomes. It's an experience of being angry or frustrated. But when we do those three questions, it's the most authentic way I know of to cultivate a sense of gratitude and appreciation for the things that we're receiving in our life. So Nikon and those questions really represent kind of the reflective side of Japanese psychology.
Interesting. You know, when I read that too, how I felt when I was reading it, it was about taking ownership and responsibility too for your own life, and it takes the blame off of others, and it just helps. I don't know. I think it makes, personally, it helps me feel more like I don't want to use the word control, but I've got a more understanding of the world around me, because things have a domino effect. And, you know, there's no such thing as perfection. It's like, you know, in your newsletter, you shared a piece that I read recently. It was from Elizabeth Gilbert on the topic of being out of balance. And it's like, that's a load of hooey trying to be balanced, because that's another new cage version of being perfect. And it's such a powerful thing. And so it's a matter of learning, you know, navigating through life where I don't know. I'm not articulating what I'm trying to express here. But the importance of, I guess, what I'm trying to get is being aware, and that's the beginning things. That's the beginning thing, and it's not a matter of like, you know what reminds me of is that, you know, that phrase about if a butterfly flaps its wings, it causes a tsunami on the other end of the world, other end of the earth. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that our actions and our responses and our things, it is a domino effect. It's like that old story of the man who comes home and kicks the cat, you know, because he had a bad day at work and it was like a domino effect, and it would have just shortened the thing if he just came home and kicked the cat. Not that I advise doing that. I don't believe in abusing animals, but that's the whole concept, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things you said in terms of kind of this idea of the effect of taking action is that there's the actual actions that we take, right? And that could be as simple as something that we say to someone or making a phone call. Those are all actions. Then there's this other category that includes things like decisions and thoughts. One of the things that I try to differentiate between in my book is that for all of your decisions and thoughts and ideas, those things themselves have no impact on the world. Whereas the simplest action, like a butterfly's wings, for example, or to just give you a simple example from my own life, I played basketball the other day with this group of guys, and we're in the locker room, and I'm getting ready to leave, and I hear from the other side of the locker room a little girl's voice singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. It's not the kind of thing usually they're in the men's locker room. So as I'm walking out of the locker room, I get to the door, and I see that there's this, you know, man, and he's got his little four-year-old girl with him, you know, going to the gym, and she was the one who was singing. And I actually turned around and I went up to her and I said, you know, I just wanted you to know that we don't usually get to listen to music in the locker room, and it was such a pleasure listening to you sing that song, you know. And she gave me this big smile, and the father said, okay, say thank you to the man, you know. And but see, by saying that to her, like, I actually took action, whereas I could have walked out of that room and I could have thought, oh, that was so sweet that little girl sang that song. And that's just a thought. And so one of the things that I want to communicate to people is that it's the actions that you take, even if it's just complimenting a little girl and singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm, those actions send ripples out into the world. And you have no idea how it's going to impact on the world, you know, one ripple after another. But when we go to sleep at night and we had all these great ideas, like, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to write this book, and I'm going to, you know, and I had a thought like, oh, this person was so nice that they did this for me, but we don't actually take any action in response to those thoughts and ideas, we're having no impact on the world. So if you think about it that way, the value of even the most brilliant idea, if it's not acted upon, is really zero, right? There's no benefit to any of the other 7 billion people on this planet. But even saying thank you to the person who bagged our groceries can have a ripple effect because there is an action involved in saying thank you. And so as we learn to kind of become more action-oriented, it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, we're getting up earlier in the morning and we're working so much harder. It means that we're basically realizing that the way that we can make a contribution and have an impact on the world around us is really making sure that we turn those thoughts and ideas and decisions into actual action in the reality of our lives.
Right. And I've personally, you know, when I was reading this stuff, I was like, I felt kind of good about myself in a conceited way, because one of the things that it would bother me, it would just bother me crazy when I'd pull into a parking spot. I know there's lots of space on my side to get out of the car, but then someone pulls in next to me and I can't even get in or get out when I get off a shift, and I'd have to crawl through the passenger side to get into the driver's side. And I thought, I can be angry about this and get upset, or learn to be more flexible physically without it being
right.
an issue climbing in the passenger side of my car. So I've made it a point, and this is going to probably sound crazy to those listening, but I'll look and see the lines, and I will make sure my car is lined up, and I'll do my absolute best to be courteous to whomever the person is next to me, whether there's a car there or not. And it's like, whether, you know, we can't, you know, control what other people are doing. But my focus and thoughts are, if I'm putting that good energy out there, it will have a ripple effect. And it will, you know, it will help another person. Maybe somebody who got off work is really, really exhausted. They're tired. The last thing they want to deal with, maybe they, like, I work at a hospital, a pediatric hospital. It can be very stressful, especially in the emergency department. But they could have gotten off a shift. There could have been just a traumatic experience. And the last thing they need to see is some car that's parked right up next to them where they have to crawl through. You know, so it's like I think of those situations that could happen simply if trying to be courteous when you park your vehicle. And that's just a small example. Another one, you know, like if you're walking down the street, there's trash on the ground. Well, who's going to pick it up? People walk right past it. So, you know, if you can, pick it up and put it in the trash. I mean, those are just really simple, basic examples, but this is what I was trying to express earlier about the domino effect. You know, people observe that stuff, and you're not doing it for self-glorification. You're doing it because you want to give something back that's bigger than you that can help, you know, like you were saying earlier about complimenting someone, not keeping it in your head, but expressing it and saying thank you or whatever the situation is.
Yeah, and you know, and the the story you mentioned about the trash is also a great way of, it's an example of another, I think, important point that comes from Japanese psychology, because I go for walks on our road, and, you know, we live out in the country, and periodically I'll see a beer can on the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be a mile from the house, and I think, like, who threw this beer can on the road? How inconsiderate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I may initially start to bend down to pick it up, but then there's this thought in my head, like, well, if I pick this up, I have to walk with it for a mile. And it's still got some beer in it, and it kind of smells, and it's kind of got some mud on it. And I don't really want to have to walk another mile with this kind of gross beer can in my hand. And then I have another thought, which is, what if people who know me see me? They'll think that I'm actually taking a walk drinking beer, you know, and I don't want people to think that about me. And so what happens is my feelings and thoughts about myself, how am I going to look, how am I going to feel, become the primary basis for how I make that decision of whether to pick up the trash or not. And in Japanese psychology, what we try to do is to get people to shift that focus away from themselves, you know, and what are people going to think of me, and am I going to be comfortable, and is this going to be pleasant or unpleasant, to the question of what needs to be done. In other words, what are the needs of the situation? So when I look at that beer can on the road and I simply say, what are the needs of the situation? The answer is obvious to me, which is the needs of the situation are that I need to pick up this beer can and get the trash off the road. And then any other thoughts or feelings I have are just kind of, you know, interesting but not relevant to picking up the can. Because what I've done is I've shifted my focus away from myself and my feelings and thoughts, and onto the world around me. Right? What are the needs of the situation in the world around me? And so, in very simple terms, it's a shift from being self-centered to being kind of world-centered. But interestingly enough, that shift also relieves a lot of the suffering that comes when we go through our life so self-absorbed. And what we find is that it's people who are self-absorbed who actually experience the most greatest amount of psychiatric and mental health problems. In fact, a heightened degree of self-focused attention is actually associated with virtually every psychological syndrome or problem that there is in the research that they've done. So what we want to do is, if we want to become psychologically more healthy, we have to become psychologically less self-centered and less self-absorbed.
Mm. Wow. That is so very, very true. And I like what you said about, you know, becoming more world conscious. I think it broadens the horizons a lot more. You know, my sister-in-law lives up in Friday Harbor in the San Juan Islands, and she often goes out to the beaches, and she'll post on Facebook and remind people that if you're out walking on the beaches, to pick up the trash, because there's stuff that always gets washed up on the beach. And it's like, it's those simple things like, you know, being conscientious of the world. Don't wait for the whoever, you know, cleans the parks to be the one that's doing that. It's everybody's responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's all of us that's responsible for taking care of this planet. And it shifts that selfish focus off on, well, that's somebody else's job, instead of saying, it's my job, you know, it's my responsibility. I'm here, I'm enjoying this space, you know, I can fully take care of this too. And it kind of goes into, there was a section here that I really enjoyed. It was working with the conditions we encounter. Now, I have known people and I've worked with people over the years that their situation is, it's pretty heartbreaking and it can be very discouraging, etc. But I really enjoyed this example of a tree, that wherever you plant the tree has to deal with what it has in, you know, in its surroundings, in how the soil condition is, how the air condition is, etc. But this tree doesn't stand there complaining about where it's at, and it doesn't complain where its lot in life and the kids that kick it or hang things or carve into its bark. It does what it does, and it does the best it can with the situation at hand. And it's like, I thought that was really powerful, because we can, how often do we do that? We complain about our conditions and our situations and the environment and the, you know, everything and out there. We want to blame, instead of making the best of what we have and how to utilize it and to help us. Am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, and you know, and that story was shared with me, and I wanted to put it in the book because I think it really does make this wonderful point that it's so easy for us to look at our lives and see the things that aren't ideal, you know, which for most of us it's very easy to find things that aren't ideal. Maybe, you know, came from a dysfunctional family and there was alcoholism or drug addiction or spouse abuse or something that went on in your family, and maybe there's illness and disease that you have or a member of your family has, or you have arthritis or you have heart disease or cancer, and I think that one of the things that I find in terms of kind of working with people's stories over the last 25 years is that, you know, everybody has stories of their struggles and their challenges and difficulties. And a lot of times we don't realize that, because when we see somebody, even someone we know, we often just see kind of the tip of the iceberg. We see the what they show in public, but we don't really know what's going on in their private lives and in the background of their personal lives. And so we all have difficult conditions that we have to work with. And if you think about it, you know, we can respond to that in a couple of different ways. And one of the ways we can respond to it is through self-pity and constantly complaining, you know, why did this have to happen to me, and why do I have to deal with this now? And I want to be very honest with your listeners, because I'm in that camp sometimes. You know, I don't do this perfectly, and there are times when I'm faced with problems or challenges, sometimes they're related to the computer or something, and I do have that response. You know, I complain,
sure,
or I feel sorry for myself. But, you know, the more enlightened approach is really to just recognize, okay, this just kind of comes with the package of my life, you know, that I have to deal with this injury, with this disease, with this difficulty in my extended family, with these financial problems. And so we work with that situation as best we can. We do the best we can under the circumstances that have been given to us. And if we can change those circumstances, that's wonderful. Go ahead and do it. But in many cases, we can't change our circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, we have limits to what we can control and what we can't. And so you're in the family you were born into, whether those people are, you know, brilliant, enlightened people, or whether they're really struggling, dysfunctional people, that's your family. And you do the best you can within that situation. And when we do that, I think we really show our own enlightened kind of approach to life. And when we just resort to complaining about it or feeling sorry for ourselves, we not only create more suffering for ourselves, but as those of us know, when we're around people who are doing that, we create more suffering for the people who are around us as well.
Right. Oh, that's so very true, because it goes back into the victim mindset about, oh, you know, my life is miserable and it's everybody else's fault, or I never get a good hand, or I this or I that. And it's sad, because I mean, I know it can be tough. I mean, I know people who have chronic illnesses, and it's really interesting, Greg. It's like, I've had a guest on my show a couple years ago, and her book was titled How to Be Sick, and she has a chronic illness. It can be very debilitating. It can be where, you know, she can't even get out of bed that day. But she has she learned about a Buddhist mindset, and it was really interesting, her whole perspective and her attitude. It was beautiful. She has good days and bad days, but she doesn't sit there bemoaning and complaining and crying about it, whereas I know other people, that's all they do, or I'm just getting by, or, you know, you're breathing, you have a way to do something with your life, but they're so set on that negative self-centered thing. And it's so interesting how people can have similar circumstances, but it's their attitude and their perception of it that can make or break, you know, their, you know, how they are as a person, and their quality of life is what I guess I'm getting at. There's something I wanted to discuss too. We've only got 12 minutes left of this show. This is so good. It was I loved this chapter, I Get To. And when I read this, I'm like, it was a light bulb. I'm like, ooh, I love this, because how often do we complain about things in life? Like, I don't have a dishwasher. I have to do everything by hand. And I don't mind. There's times, though, I have, you know, I'll complain, like, I would love to have a dishwasher, especially with two growing boys that are constantly eating. But using the phrase of, instead of I have to or I should, changing it to I get to. And I thought, this is powerful, because how often do we forget we've got fresh running water, hot and cold, that comes into the house. We don't have to go down to a stream and fetch it and then boil it over a fire that you have to start with two sticks. You know, I mean, there's like, it's about a finding gratitude in where you're at. So I'd love for you to dive into this one for a little bit.
Well, you know, I have, something, again, that was passed on to me. A lot of the material in the book, you know, I wish I could take more credit for this all being like my brilliant ideas, but it's really material that I've collected from my students and colleagues and teachers, you know, over 20 years, that I just tried to pull together into a single book. And this one came from a woman that did a retreat here named Kate, and I remember her very clearly, and she passed on this idea, and I thought that this really is brilliant, because what happens is it shifts the way you use language is very important, in my opinion, and it really shifts all of the energy away from this sense of burden and obligation, like, oh, now I have to make dinner. Oh, now I have to go pick the kids up from school. Like, you know, what a burden, what an obligation. But when you say I get to, now I get to pick the kids up from school. Now I get to walk the dog. Now I get to make dinner. And, you know, I have two children also, two teenage girls, and my wife and I split the cooking. And so I cook half of the dinners. And there are nights when I do have that attitude, like, oh, now I have to figure out what to make for dinner. But my girls are in high school, and they may be in college in a couple of years, and I'm not going to have that opportunity to be making them dinner very often.
Right.
And so at that point, I may realize that it really was a blessing and a privilege to be able to make dinner for them. And what a wonderful thing if I can realize that while they're still here, and I still have that opportunity until, instead of waiting until they're gone and away and not living with me anymore and then regretting that, you know, I don't have the opportunity to make them dinner very much. So so we can do a lot just by the shifting of our language. I often, when I work with people one-on-one, I often listen to their language and sometimes really kind of challenge them with the way that they're using language. If somebody is saying that they feel hopeless and depressed, and they say, you know, and I feel just feel like I'm paralyzed and there's nothing I can do, and I point out to them that the word paralyzed has a very clear medical meaning to it. It literally means that you're incapable of moving a muscle, right? And that's not your situation. So it's really not a good choice of language. It's a choice that disempowers us, if you think of it that way, right? By
right.
characterizing ourselves that way. And so there's great value, I think, in just watching the words that we choose to use and being aware of kind of our speech, because sometimes just that shift from I have to I get to can make a huge difference in terms of the kind of energy that we stir up both for ourselves and again for the people around us.
Right. Oh, it's so, so very true. You had a chapter in here called Impermanence and Legos. Now, I've got boys, and I so got this because we have that movie, too. You talk about the Lego movie and how this relates with life, and I would love for you to share a little bit more about this, about the idea behind impermanence is the essence of everything. You quoted Pema Chodron.
Yeah, and, you know, it was funny because I was watching that movie, and I started out, for your listeners who have seen the Legos movie, you know, I started thinking, oh, this is kind of a silly movie. And then the more I watched it, and the more it started to unfold that, you know, that the evil character in the movie is the one that wants all the Legos to always stay glued to the same spot. And they really represent, you know, the complete absence of change, the complete absence of creativity. And I thought the person who wrote the script for this was really brilliant. But I think it's you know, it becomes a question of, and I would recommend that movie when you see it, if you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
You know, be conscious of this issue of impermanence and change, because it's right there in the Lego movie, and it's probably, you know, one of the main principles of Buddhism and of Eastern philosophy is that, you know, everything is changes, everything is impermanent. And so we can embrace that. You know, we can embrace that impermanence and recognize that whatever our situation, it's going to change. If we're happy with our situation, sorry, but it's going to change. And if we're unhappy with our situation, great, it's going to change. It's just
exactly.
It's just the way the world works, right? And a lot of our struggles, I think, are based on this idea of trying to get our life together and then keeping it together. And it's very similar to the Lego movie, where you're trying to get all your little Legos in the right place and then keeping them there. And it just doesn't work. And it doesn't work in our life
right.
either, because as soon as you get this part of your life together, something happens and this part of your life falls apart. And to me, the best approach is to be able to just embrace that process, that it really is the process of things coming together and things falling apart, and then they come together again and then they fall apart, and that's really the way life is supposed to be. They're not supposed to be glued to their spots. They're supposed to be flexible and movable. so that you can keep creating and building things that are new. So it's a wonderful movie, and it makes a wonderful point about change and impermanence.
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, and from a mom's perspective, you know, my boys have Legos, and it started off with, you know, kits and, you know, all of these things. Now they have this bin that used to be all of these creations that got torn apart, rebuilt. And it cracks me up because, like, recently my kids got a couple Lego sets, you know, small little spaceship or whatever it was for Christmas. And my oldest son, there's always a few pieces left over. And I'm looking, I'm like, I don't think those are extra. He goes, oh, there's always extra pieces. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to argue because you're using what you have, and you morphed whatever was in the box into something else. And then half the time that's going to get torn apart, and all those extra quote-unquote pieces are going to get used in something else. So I personally really enjoy that. I've met parents who say that their child has a really hard time with Legos because they want it to be exactly the way the picture is. And it's like,
right.
Legos are such a beautiful example of it doesn't have to be exact. It could be anything you choose to create. And it's a beautiful physical example of how life is. You know, you can create it the way you want it to be with what you have, with the tools that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, there's so much more in your book that I thoroughly enjoy. You talk about dealing with deadlines, taking action in relationships, basically taking action in general, what that really means. It's like, it's just small steps, small baby steps sometimes is, you know, like being like a turtle. You got to do something is better than nothing, and then just keep moving forward.
Yeah, you know, and if I can, I know we're getting close to the end of the show, but I think, you know, one of the things I'd like to leave your listeners with is this idea of how important momentum is.
Yeah.
You know, momentum is tremendously important in terms of moving forward in your life, and that's where the small steps come in, because most of us, if we have a dream or a goal or an idea, you know, we're impatient. We want to see that happen, like, right away. You know, we want to get that book written because we're excited about it, and we want to get it written in the next month. And for most people, that's not the way it's going to get written. And so we need to learn to we can have that enthusiasm, but if we can start writing a page a day, right, or a paragraph a day, if we can take those small steps, then it's not just that we start, you know, getting chapters finished or, you know, multiple pages written, but we start getting momentum. And that momentum continues to provide us with energy the next day and the next day and the next day. And so whether it's exercise or writing a book or, you know, saving money or building a house, if we can do it in these little steps, it doesn't seem like a lot, you know, when we start, because it seems like, oh, this is going to take me forever. But it's the way that, you know, epic books get written,
mm-hmm.
is by someone who decides that they can do a page a day, that's doable. And it's mm-hmm. not as off-putting as the idea is, okay, I'm going to spend the whole Saturday working on my book, see if I can get, like, 3 chapters done. That's a huge task, and psychologically that's very challenging. But psychologically, to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to work for 20 minutes and see if I can write one good paragraph, you know, for many of us, like, okay, I can take a crack at that. So for people who are trying to start something that seems big or challenging, just start with very, very small steps, but do them consistently. You know, just do a little bit, a few minutes a day, and it's amazing how you find over a period of time that you're starting to see something happen. You're starting to see something kind of get created that was just an idea a few weeks or a few months ago.
Absolutely, and you know, I was just listening, and I was like, you know, one of the things that I do, like, especially with my show, is I read the books that are sent to me from cover to cover. So when I'm talking to the author, I want to give you obviously my full attention, but have a really good grasping or understanding of what your message is, what your story is, what. And so I've had to, it's taken me time to figure out, okay, so I know how long it takes me to read, you know, a 200 or 300 or 400 page book. depending on what the topic is. And so it's taken a lot of discipline and I have to choose to read a chapter over doing something else that seems like more fun. So I get it. So we're going to have to wrap up in just a few seconds. Again, everyone, thank you, Greg, for joining me today. The website is thetodoinstitute.org, and please visit the website. I also have a link for your book, The Art of Taking Action, Lessons from the Japanese Psychology, on this web link as well. And I do recommend everyone get a copy of this book and visit the website. And also, real quick, I want to plug your newsletter. Is this something that they can just sign up for real quick online?
It's called 30,000 Days, and if you go to todoinstitute.org, you can basically find information.